KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we talk with David Simon, creator of The Corner and The Wire, as well as a recent film about Iraq called Generation Kill. We'll talk with him about his work, and we'll get his views on a number of different subjects, including newspapers, urban poverty, and what he calls raw, unencumbered capitalism. He joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. David Simon, for 13 years, a Baltimore Sun crime reporter, is the author of Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which became an NBC television series produced by Barry Levinson. In 1997, he co-wrote The Corner, all about Baltimore's drug world, which became an HBO miniseries, and he's also the creator and brains behind a highly praised and much admired, especially for its authenticity, HBO series The Wire that first debuted in June of 2002 and focused on the urban dynamics of race, drugs, and crime. The Wire ran for 5 seasons. David Simon is also the creator with Ed Burns of the miniseries Generation Kill, a film about a Marine platoon in Iraq based on a 2004 book by Evan Wright. And David Simon joins us for this hour from the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, where he's currently writer-in-residence for this week. And welcome to the program. Good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. We just did a program, actually, the last hour on the Mission District in San Francisco and the spike in violence there. So it's kind of an appropriate segue to begin by asking you about, well, the content of what we were talking about last hour. Specifically, I was struck by an article you did for The Guardian, that is the UK Guardian, about Baltimore and about a city that you see as one where jurors are now more reluctant to convict criminal defendants than they are, let's say, out in the suburbs. And you said the question that's not being asked about cities and about crimes in districts like the Mission District and rising crime is why, and why cities themselves have ceased to exist in the way that they used to exist. Let's talk about that from your perspective.
Well, I think the Guardian piece was making an argument to the British audience for The Wire, which is actually out of proportion to what it should be. I don't know why, but it's a hit over there for some reason. And they tend to believe that the dystopia shown in The Wire is all of my city. And really what The Wire was about was the America that got left behind. There's a completely different moneyed and viable America that exists side by side with the part of America that is not any more connected to our society or economy, and it's been so for a few generations. And I was just trying to point that out.
Well, this is the America of the gangbangers that we were talking about in the last hour, or the impoverished. And you're saying that the neglect is really a great part of the cause and behind those effects,
and the fact that very little in the way of actual interaction is occurring between the two anymore. Journalism has been eviscerated, at least high-end journalism, and the reporters who might have been asking more complex questions about where we're headed as a society, they're no longer at newspapers and or even doing that kind of work at magazines in the numbers they used to be. They're certainly not in my city, and I'm amazed that events occur in my city and go unremarked upon, or connections are not made, or nobody attempts to do the reporting to make connections. That was kind of what the Guardian piece was about anyway.
Yeah, let me ask you about newspapers, because here you are at UC Berkeley School of Journalism, and I saw part of a lecture you gave the USC School of Journalism, and you were a newspaper guy and a reporter for years covering the crime beat in Baltimore and still live there. And a lot has been made out of I don't know, grudges that you've had with newspaper people that used to, like John Carroll, whom we've had on this program, the former editor of the Los Angeles Times, who used to be at the Baltimore Sun. Mm-hmm. But less coverage and buyouts and tabloid and bogus news have come under your kind of criticism. And some would say it's all economics. They're just not getting the ads, and the Internet is encroaching, and younger readers
right.
aren't there.
That would be one narrative that journalists and journalism was innocently going along, making the world safe for democracy, doing their jobs heroically, being underpaid, doing all the great things journalism is supposed to do. And then this this new technology showed up and just, you know, kicked the hell out of the industry. That is one narrative. It has some merit in that the internet has been a profound change, an unbelievably profound change, and newspapers were going to have to change in order to contend with it. But I actually took a buyout in 1995. It was the third buyout offered at the Baltimore Sun. I was one of the 100 reporters out of about a newsroom of 500 that left. And this is long before the internet. I was part of the crew that came into journalism in the 70s, believed that newspapers were going to get more sophisticated. The storytelling was going to get more complex. We were going to do more meaningful work. And instead, what happened at the Baltimore Sun in those years is that they took profits. We were making money in the double-digit range, about, you know, up to 20%, and the margins were great, and they went back to stockholders for the out-of-town newspaper chain. And what happened to my newspaper was it became less sophisticated, more consumed with quote-unquote impact journalism, with the gotchas, less concerned with actually covering the city of Baltimore and figuring out what was happening in that society. And that happened under people who were regarded, as you indicate, to be the paragons of journalism. But I'm sorry, what I admired in journalism, they had no regard for, and what I admired, they didn't see much in. So, you know, we parted company. But I've always been blunt about that. And what's amusing to me is that journalists who rely on people who have let's even call it grudges for the sake of it. That is the source material for just about every tip that comes into a Metro desk. And I can't tell you the number of good stories that began with somebody calling in because they were pissed off about something. And yet, the only response when I start to argue substance on this issue is to cite my alienation from a couple of guys and suggest that ad hominem is the answer to the substance, that, well, we don't have to listen to what he's saying because he doesn't like X or he doesn't like Y.
Yeah, I think the Atlantic Monthly tried to do that to some extent.
Well, you know, they did it with a gentleman who actually is a contemporary of John and Bill. They worked with him at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He had hired Bill Marimo.
Who is also a character in The Wire, we should mention.
No, Bill Marimo is not a character.
The name of a character in The Wire.
There was a Charlie Marimo who was a very bad police lieutenant, but yeah. Bill Marimo was not a character in The Wire. But I should say that, you know, I was very disappointed in Mark Bowden's approach because, you know, unstated was the fact that he was lifelong friends with these guys, and that's really what it was. I sort of admired his tenacity in terms of, you know, defending his friends, but the substance of the piece was left a lot.
Well, he did say that they were that he had friendships with them. He was at least upfront about this. But I'm struck by when you talk about the newspaper, you say my newspaper. When you talk about Baltimore, you say my city. I mean, you have a kind of, and I know that you started out. And in fact, I should mention to listeners, the last season of The Wire, in fact, had to do with journalism. And David Simon kind of got his start by going with his dad at age 5. I learned to see front page. As far as journalism, but that kind of personal
investment—not age 5. But
that's
a little older.
A little older, okay. Yeah, the inaccuracy of journalism.
Yeah, no, I was about 12, I think.
This strikes me though, this sense of personal investment that you have in these things, which would probably serve the citizenry and people a lot better if they, well, if they developed it more. I mean, you really do have a stake in your city, and you seem to come across as being very invested in it as well as in journalism.
I still live in Baltimore. Everybody's got to be somewhere. I live in Baltimore.
Everybody's got to be somewhere. That's the old joke, yeah. Right, about the guy in the closet, right?
That's right. I mean, yeah, but it's true. I mean, I live in Baltimore. I've lived there since 1983, and I regard the Sun as my alma mater. My alma mater. What's happened to that newspaper and many others like it in America is heartbreaking. But I do regard it as a failure of vision of the industry that has much more to do with a variety of things than merely the arrival of the internet. And I don't know how my city gets better without a quality newspaper. I don't see it happening. The weight of lies and statistics that are thrown up by various institutions in the city in order to maintain programs that aren't working, policies that aren't working, And to see none of this examined in any kind of systemic way, and this has been going on, you know, by degrees. The paper's been falling apart since the late 80s.
It's not only the newspapers, though, from your perspective, because I've certainly read a lot of your statements, and we'll go into some more of them in the course of this hour, as well as I want to, of course, talk about your work and your recent miniseries, most recent miniseries, Generation Kill. But there's a sense, and you kind of targeted, of the American entertainment industry. They, in fact, you say they get poverty relentlessly wrong. These are people who never meet anybody from the other America as you see it.
Well, it's sort of an overgeneralization, but I don't watch a lot of television. But when I do sort of stumble across it, it's basically designed as an entertainment, most of it. And why not? I mean, it's an entertainment industry. I'm sort of in the wrong industry, so my critique doesn't really mean anything. it's a journalist's critique of something that is designed to do something else.
But you've got a big soapbox now because of The Wire, don't you?
I'm trying to use it, aren't I? If it comes across as a rant, I think in some ways my job is to be a gadfly because ultimately this window that is HBO, at some point they're going to figure out that, you know, I don't know how to write a hit television show, and they're going to slam the window shut on my hands, and, you know, I'll be back to working on books or something else. But for right now, it's this marvelous tool that, you know, I mean, a couple years ago I read a biography of Edward Murrow, and he looked upon television as this incredible tool that was being so misused in terms of reaching a mass audience and educating a mass audience and creating a dynamic of discussion and argument. And at least now with the sort of the balkanization of television, with all these channels doing very different things, and you know, you can now get something on the air without having to get 20 million eyeballs on it, the possibilities seem at least, you know, possibilities.
Well, you've said about The Wire, you've said it's dissent.
Yeah, it is. It is a critique of what the writing staff of The Wire feels has gone wrong in America. It is not a critique of everything. It's not a depiction of America in total. There are whole elements that went unremarked upon in the show's five seasons. But it took on what it took on and tried to be a bit argumentative about who we are as a people and where we're going.
You're also inclined to, when you say it's not a depiction of American Toto, though, to make statements about the decline of the American empire, about raw, unencumbered capitalism being responsible for the devaluation of human beings. These seem almost like quasi-ideological points of view. Is that behind The Wire?
I don't think they're ideological. I don't have an ideology. You know, when you talk about raw and unencumbered capitalism, I'm saying that as somebody who believes that capitalism is the only viable engine for generating mass wealth. I don't see an alternative to capitalism, certainly in the postmodern era. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to have a society and it's going to have any measure of a just core to it, of any moral center, and if it's going to maintain itself going forward in ways that I think we can all be proud of, it has to be mitigated by some kind of social compact. And there has to be some sense of, you know, to put it in more simple terms, that we're all in this together. And I think that has been lost. I think that was lost pretty much the moment Ronald Reagan said that we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. And people laughed and thought it was a clever line. I think something went out of us at that moment psychically, and it certainly went out of my city, because I live 20 blocks away, as do a lot of Baltimoreans. I live 20 blocks away from a very different America that is utterly disconnected socially, economically. Their future is not my future. We're not sharing a future together.
Well, before Homicide came out, and we should mention that Barry Levinson was living out here for a while, so he was no stranger to this program, and we got to know him pretty well. But I remember talking with him about the innovation of that program. I know you work with Tom Fontana also, who was largely involved in a major way in that program. Suddenly we had a whole different view of the streets than we'd had on any kind of television before. And the fact is that from the entertainment industry, again, maybe Baltimore was pictured as some of Barry Levinson's earlier films, like Tin Man and Diner, or like John Waters' films.
Yeah, there's a lot of different Baltimores. There's Ann Tower's books. There's Laura Lippman's books. There's John Waters. There's Barry Levinson. I don't know why Baltimore has done as well as it has in terms of storytelling. I don't know why it's – maybe because it's – you got me. I've been thinking about that a while. I've been asked that question about three or four times in the last.
It's funny geographical. I mean, it's kind of southern but not southern, and near Washington and all that.
Industrial but post-industrial. In a way, a lot of our storytelling in television and film has centered on New York and L.A. and Washington, for obvious reasons. One being the capital of government, one being the financial capital and the cultural capital, and the other one being the place where the entertainment industry is located. And then the rest of the cities are sort of generic in the minds of most of our entertainment culture, but they're not generic, and they're as idiosyncratic as any other place. And Baltimore is, in some ways, wonderfully idiosyncratic, and yet it still remains. It still can stand in for every city. So maybe it's just a good place to tell stories.
It's also got the Poe mystique as well. We're talking to David Simon, author, journalist, television producer, creator, and head writer of the HBO series The Wire. Kind of sad it's over, David.
The Wire?
Yeah,
I miss working with those people. We had fun. It was a good run, and we were proud of the work we did. But there comes a time where it's time to tell new stories. Start constructing a new universe, and we had planned out the arcs and planned the end. We planned the beginning, the middle, and the end, and it was it felt good to end on our own terms. That doesn't happen often in television.
So you went to Iraq. You went from Bag.
I didn't.
Well, Generation Kill was.
I went to South Africa, which stood in for Iraq. We were brought Evan Wright's book by HBO. They had purchased it, and they were trying to figure out how to do it, and I admired the journalism tremendously. I thought it was the equivalent of, for this war, of Michael Herr's Dispatches. I thought it was that good. And Ed and I set out to try to carry the book into the visual and remain true to the book and remain very consistent with the facts in the book and not to interpose.
And it is a true story of combat, we should mention.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the real names of the Marines are used. The real events are followed. The dialogue is directly from, key moments of the dialogue are directly from the book itself. And it comes to you without anything hyperbolic about the war or the politics behind the war, things that these young Marines, were indifferent to. It really is their point of view and no other.
Speaking about war and politics, there is a character who calls the Marine Corps America's little pit bull, and I presume that's without lipstick. Do you have a candidate in this race for president?
I wouldn't say. I should parry that by saying that I'm from a state where my vote doesn't count, so it really doesn't matter. I don't know about you, but I live in an oligarchy, and who governs my country is determined by people that I don't know in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida and Michigan.
The Wire has been compared to Dickens. It's been compared to great Victorian novels. You yourself have talked about maybe stealing from the great Greek dramatists. It seems to me that kind of company can be pretty heady. You seem to sound like a modest man in many ways. How do you keep your humility in the wake of all the praise that The Wire has had? Some people call, I think Jacob Weinstein called it the best thing ever put on television.
You don't get upset when they write stuff like that, but I do tend to send back email. I remember the guy from Time magazine compared it to Balzac, and I spelled Balzac a very different way. And acted like it was an insult and sent him an email back and said, come to Baltimore and say that. I dare you. It is fair to say that we did not approach doing that television show by looking at other television shows as a model. It was written by people who had done either long narrative nonfiction prose or novels. That was the writing staff. And we really did structure it as per a modern multi-POV novel. But, you know, do I think it stands against this or that, or do I think it ought to be called, the, you know, listen, you know, let's stick the DVDs in a machine 10 years from now and watch it and see if it even stands up. Who knows? You know, it's hard to say what we made.
Well, when we had Richard Price on, he was talking about the kind of esprit de corps that existed among writers there. And you've had people like Dennis Lehane. I mean, you've had certainly a core of first-rate writers that you managed, as you suggested.
It's been a delight. Yeah, it's really – listen, things may have gone wrong in somebody's script, and people may have lost pages they wish were filmed. And I mean, we had lots of wonderful debates, but – in the end, the one thing that I could promise everybody when they came to work on the show was, in the end, if you lose a fight, you'll lose it to another writer. You know, it won't be because the actor wants more lines or because the director needed a crane shot, or, you know, it's going to be about story. And that was that made the writers' meetings fun.
Think you've paved the way for better TV, maybe?
Yeah, by getting my ratings? No. I don't think so.
You also said at one point that you care most about the people that you're writing about recognizing themselves in the work. That was kind of an ongoing ethos, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And that's been that was the case when I started writing books and even magazine articles. You know, when I started getting past daily journalism and into sort of more enterprising reporting. It doesn't mean I wanted the people I was writing about to agree with everything that I was saying. You know, at some point you have to be true to the journalism and not to, you know, appeasing your subjects. But I wanted them to acknowledge that I was, you know, that the mindset of their world, that the vernacular of their world, that the details, that somebody got that right. And that's been true up to the last project with the Marines. And, you know, one of the things that was gratifying for me personally in the last season of The Wire was I heard from an awful lot of journalists, and not just people I knew, but, you know, when I would go to various cities. And the same thing happened that had happened in all the other seasons of The Wire, which is the people who were the sergeants and lieutenants and grunts in the newsroom saw the piece as being very indicative of what they were going through, and the captains and majors and colonels were offended. And that's always been the reaction to every single season, you know, of The Wire, whether it was the Baltimore Police Department or the school system or the politics, you know. Labor and middle management get it, and upper management acts as if you've affronted everything they believe in.
We're talking to David Simon, and we're coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number. Before I do, though, let me get back to Generation Kill for a moment with you, if I may. And in fact, there's a character in there who wants to move to San Francisco, a kind of new age guy, because he says he thinks there are no fat people here. Just mention that for the record, get a local angle. Were you trying to say something about that generation that grew up on video games and a different attitude toward combat, or, you know, that they had?
Well, I wasn't, but
I mean,
Evan
from
Wright
the book,
very, Evan Wright very much stated that theme in the book, and I thought he made it clear in the book. I thought it was very compelling. They were not much was regarded, not much was expected from that generation of warrior by our volunteer military. They were untested, and they were held suspect, and they actually performed pretty well in the end is the verdict.
Let me give out the phone number, because I know there are many of you who would like the opportunity to speak to Mr. Simon, who is with us from the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, where he's this week serving as writer-in-residence. You can join us toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. That toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with the creator of The Wire, David Simon, who calls his critically acclaimed HBO series a political tract masquerading as a cop show. And he's an author, journalist, and television producer, and also the author of Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which inspired the Emmy Award-winning television program of the same name. And he created the recent HBO miniseries Generation Kill about Marines in Iraq. He's with us from the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, where he's currently this week serving as writer-in-residence. And we're going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I just wanted to ask however, David Simon, if I may, a sense of, I was just thinking about, well, how you feel about decriminalization of drugs, because I know Kurt Schmoke was in fact, the series The Wire in a couple of episodes, I believe.
Played the health commissioner.
Yeah, he played the health commissioner. And then you had that Hamsterdam decriminalized area and so forth. And he was someone who actually took a very strong stand about decriminalization. So do you have strong feelings?
It ended his political career.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, not as mayor, but he was probably destined for the Clinton cabinet, and they wouldn't touch him
right.
after he... And all he did was say, we should discuss drug policy because this is not working. Prohibition is not working. We should have a discussion about harm reduction and decriminalization. His police department actually continued locking people up at an incredible rate. There was no change in policy on the ground in Baltimore. He just wanted to have a discussion about it. And even talking about the matter was political suicide.
Well, but from your perspective, did you want to get that position, that point of view across?
I've been unequivocal about this. You know, and I'm somebody who really admires good police work. You know, my first book was all about good police work. But, the drug policy is a complete and abject failure and has been for 40 years. But the one thing that I keep trying to get across that, again, it's counterintuitive, and you don't get it unless you've done a lot of reporting at the street level, is that the drug wars actually destroyed the police deterrent. In every city where drug arrests have gone up, and to no effect because the drugs are still plentiful and potent, the arrest rates for the clearance rates for major felonies go down. Because you're basically training your police to do the lowest common denominator of work, which is grab guys off the street and go in their pockets. We raised generations of cops in my city who can't write a search warrant, who can't construct an investigation, who can't use and not be used by an informant, who can't testify in court without perjuring themselves. All they can do is go in guys' pockets. So, you know, you kill somebody, you rape somebody, you rob somebody in Baltimore, your chance of getting away with it is infinitely better than it was 20 years ago. And we are filling the jails and the parole rolls and the probation rolls with people for nonviolent drug offenses.
Well, in fact, you make the point, a number of times you've made the point, that this is done sort of to raise the numbers for electing purposes, for electioneering purposes.
My mayor is now my governor.
Yeah, and, Martin O'Malley.
It worked beautifully for him.
Well, let me go to our callers, and we'll begin with Ian from Oakland. Morning, Ian.
Good morning, gentlemen. First and foremost, Mr. Simon, it's an honor. As somebody from Oakland, raised since the age of two, the amount of parallels that I see from The Wire to my city are astounding. All of my friends used to watch it religiously, go out of our way, whatever we had to do, we'd have to catch an episode just because it's reality. It's to the point where I feel every American, if not every person, has a responsibility to see The Wire, front to back. Really understand and see what's going on in our world.
And either buy or shoplift the DVDs, I hope.
I have season 1 through 5, actually.
I've actually heard that a lot about Oakland. I've not spent a lot of time in Oakland, but it sounds like I would be at home. I have to say I'm really curious about the city.
Well, Baltimore becomes sort of every city or every urban area for so many people who identified with the program. What about, you hear occasional criticism, though, and I wondered what you say to it, David Simon, that... you didn't portray enough of the sort of regular church-going, decent people, God-fearing people.
Well, we were dealing with social issues, and we were not dealing with a population that didn't have those issues. I think that's what I was trying to say earlier, which is that The Wire, and I was trying to say it to the Brits in that Guardian piece, The Wire does not represent all of America. It represents the America that got left behind and why it got left behind. It was an examination and a rumination on that portion of America that is in great distress. What I would say in response to people who wanted more life-affirming and middle-class and normalized stories about human beings is that there are about 379 television shows on a variety of channels. And all you have to do is flick on your Comcast and change, and you'll find all of them. There, you know, for a brief period of time, there was one television drama about the other America where things aren't working. Are they really trying to have a discussion with me about whether it was one too many? Is that really what we're doing here?
Well, in the Guardian article, you also said that The Wire, you felt, was an elegy for the death of union labor and the working class.
Well, the second season, yeah.
Yeah. which certainly hits home probably in the UK, but also here in terms of reasons behind poverty or trying to at least explain some
of the core reasons. Or climate poverty. The way out of poverty up until the late 60s in Baltimore was a union card. And it worked for some people, and that is now your that became your middle class, and that route is no longer available to the vast mass of workers or the potential workers.
Jay, you know, excuse me, I
was just going to say half of the adult males and black males in my city are unemployed.
Jay, join us. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thank you so much for making this show. I actually originally lived in Baltimore City. I'm sure you're familiar with the projects. It was called Hollander Ridge. Are you familiar with that area?
Hollander Ridge, sure.
Yeah. And they tore it all down and everything. So I was able to, you know, I went to school there, and I was able to get out of there and use somebody's address in Towson to go to high school there. And part of the show that, you know, is so many of the people in our neighborhood try to go to different schools by using other people's address to get out of that area, and, you know, because of drugs and the fights and everything. And after I went to college, I went to UMBC and I became a nurse. I went back to Hollander Ridge, and it was right at the time that they were cutting, you know, they were closing up and boarding up the houses to kick people out. But so many of my friends were either selling drugs or drug addicts, or I wound up in jail. And the show just was so, so accurate about, you know, the vicious cycle of poverty. And I just want to thank you. And it was an amazing show.
Thank you. Congratulations on the arc of your life there.
I live at Berkeley now. So.
Thanks, Jay, for the call. Good to hear from
you. So it didn't end well, but no, just kidding.
Hi, Asher. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I think David owes me an apology. Let me explain. I went down to the video store, and I rented the first season of The Wire. And then I had to sit in front of my TV for hours and hours, and it ruined my life because I went through all four seasons and, you know, became a hermit. But here's my question.
Asher, correction, there are five seasons.
There are five seasons. Yeah. Oh, you know, I think I watched...
Your long nightmare is not over.
it was an incredible series. But here's my question. You know, I was very much aware that the adults in the series were professional actors. But the youngsters, the black youngsters in the ghetto neighborhood, were so authentic in this gritty drama. And I just marveled at their dramatic talent, and I wondered how you worked with those youngsters and recruited them, and whether they were professional actors or you know what you went through. They were just absolutely terrific.
The four main kids in season four were all professional actors with a good deal of experience. They came to us with very strong credentials, and we did a lot of auditions in about four different cities, and they were the four that we settled on. But they were actually entirely from the acting ranks. You know, some of the other supporting roles were kids from Baltimore. And they did wonderfully as well. But for those four roles, we were relying on really well-trained actors. I will say that Robert Chu, who played Proposition Joe and is a local Baltimore actor and a really marvelous man, he was the acting coach. And he actually took those four actors and really worked over a lot of the key scenes before filming. He was an essential element in getting those performances.
Let me thank Asher and... I don't think you owe him an apology, but I'm wondering about the importance for you in any kind of production of this sort, whether it's The Wire or Generation Kill, of music. Because I remember in a conversation we had with Barry Levinson, he said it's far more important than most people realize, and it was of preeminent importance to him.
I tended to go a different route from Homicide. Homicide had score. We had a composer on set. We would score scenes musically. I was always uncomfortable with that. It's one aspect of film. I like the artifice of film. I'm not under the illusion that I'm making journalism. You know, I understand that I'm making a movie here. But one of the elements of artifice that bothered me the most is the use of score. I feel as if it cues the viewer what to feel, as if it makes everybody lean into punches rather than discover things on their own. So beginning with The Corner and all the way through The Wire and Generation Kill, I've used only ambient music, only music that is credibly coming from a car radio or out of a tenement window or, you know, from some band on a stage if you're in a nightclub. There has to be a legitimate source for the music for you to hear it. And then I want the music not to be entirely on point. I want it to often be in contradiction to what we're hearing or what we're seeing in terms of dialogue or scene. I read an interview a long time ago with Martin Scorsese, even before I got involved in movies, and he was talking about, I think, Mean Streets, and there's this scene where, you know, Johnny Boy's beating the guy up with the pool cue in the pool hall, and Be My Baby by the Ronettes is playing. And somebody asked him why, and he said, because when you're beating up a guy with a pool cue, the right song is never on the jukebox. and that's really life. And so I embrace that. I want to hear the sounds of the street and of the world in the background, but I want it not to be cueing emotion.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't like the way we're manipulated by music. But in fact, apropos of that, here's a listener who writes, I was intrigued by Mr. Simon's comment that he doesn't espouse any particular ideology in his work. Richard Price recently stated on Forum that he too didn't take a social or political point of view in his work, that he merely told the story and let people take it as they found it. I wonder if Mr. Simon and Mr. Price haven't tapped into the mother lode of authenticity by way of this journalistic approach, that by artistically and brilliantly reporting their story, fiction or not, they convey with much greater power and impact the emotional and spiritual truth of the world in which they live.
Well, and you also end up not preaching to the choir. Listen, I have very strong opinions about the war in Iraq. I think most Americans do. If they don't, they're probably not reading enough, whether they're for the war or against the war. I think everyone should have an opinion on us being involved in a foreign conflict. Having said that, there is no room to put what David Simon thinks about the Iraq war if I'm really going to embrace the point of view of these young Marines in Bravo Company. And that was the job. That's the storyteller's job, is to honor the subject first. Do these Marines discover things about Iraq that are politically relevant? Yes. And there are moments in the piece that clearly point to things that were to go wrong over the next 5 years in Iraq. But they're discovered from the Marine point of view. And they were discovered in reality from the Marine point of view and not from the point of view of David Simon or Evan Wright.
Let me go to a few more emails before I go to more of your calls. This is Matt who writes, I watched Generation Kill. I enjoyed it. I noticed the anxiety that some officers were incompetent. Captain America in particular was almost identical to the social abrasion in E.B. Sledge's book With the Old Breed from World War II. I think that reaction to combat may be universal. Some officers are picked out as the guys who will get us killed, frequently without much merit. I wonder if Evan Wright simply absorbed the feelings of the team he rode with and failed to see the larger picture, a picture the commander nicknamed Godfather tried to show him at the end of the series.
Well, that's a very apt message. I think the guy really got it, which was, Evan acknowledges that his point of view is in the rear seat of that Humvee, and he only knew what the Marines knew at the time. If you read the book, Evan goes to great length to explain the more strategic elements of what was happening and that there really was some cohesion to what command was doing during those 3 weeks into Baghdad. But there's no way to do that and to maintain fealty for the Marines' point of view. So at the end, when he does encounter Lieutenant Colonel Ferrando and some things are made clear, to him, it is sort of a revelation, and it does indicate that there is more than one point of view to any given event. I think Evan's reporting was incredibly accurate. At the same time, there isn't one singular truth to any event. I mean, we all understand the Rashomon logic of truth and reality, and you know, again, to use a phrase we've used once before in this conversation, everyone's got to be somewhere. Evan was in the right rear passenger seat of the lead Humvee.
But also reminded me of, it had resonances, I'm talking about the book now, of Mailer's Naked and the Dead. I mean, you know, of war novels like that, even though it was journalism and first-person observation.
I think it was a very resonant book. When I read it the first time, what amused me was that the institutional dynamic was the same as I'd seen in the police department or the school system. And, you know, certain things, you know, wherever you go, middle management is a pain in the ass in terms of, you know, they're dealing with, you know, the bosses are jerks and good help is hard to find and labor is always diminished.
And they call it Peter principles and Dilbert principles. And
yeah,
things like that.
You know what? Wherever you go, there you are. And that wasn't, you know, a lot of people might have misinterpreted Generation Kill to think, well, this is Simon and Burns and the Wire crew adapting their own, you know, institutional arguments to the Marine Corps. But they got to go back and read the book. The book was the book is being conveyed accurately.
And we should mention he's still is with Rolling Stone, I believe, isn't he? As an editor?
No, he's on his own.
He's on his own.
He's a freelancer. Yeah.
Well, here's Mark who writes, since much of the other America that you're talking about is Black America, how many Black writers and producers did you employ on the show?
Let's see, David Mills, Joy Lesko, trying to think, a couple of others for script work. Most of our, the directors who did the most work on the show were African American. Ernest Dickerson being the guy who probably directed the most episodes. I grow tired of this whole discussion. I'm really pretty indifferent to it. I'm interested in progressing minority representation within anything I do because it's sort of an essential thing for the industry going forward, and it's a delight to work with people from different backgrounds. But I'm uninterested in sort of the notion of you know, white people should write white stuff and black people should write black stuff and everyone's got their own stories and there should be no poaching. You know, it reaches a level of ridiculousness. I mean, I'm glad they let the boys write the girls or we wouldn't have Madame Bovary, you know.
Yeah, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. But there, you know, two rather distinguished guests on this program said exactly that. One was August Wilson, the famed American playwright, and the other was Spike Lee.
Well, you know, by the way, I admire both of those men. And I admire their art. And, you know, there were efforts to, you know, I mean, one of the guys who I really liked among all, you know, we were hiring a bunch of crime writers, and I desperately wanted Walter Mosley to contribute if he was interested. And I, you know, I wanted David Mills, who's been a friend of mine ever since college, to be one of the executive producers. And, you know, he had his own development deal and didn't want to, you know, he was trying to get his own stuff up, and you know, I got to respect that. And Mr. Mosley was inclined not to like The Wire originally. His first impressions of it were negative, and he didn't want to play. And I respect that. I mean, you know, he evaluated it. He thought it wasn't for him, and I regretted not having him. But at some point...
He likes stuff out of another era, though, too. You know?
Well, I mean, he's a good writer. And at some point, what I'm interested in is who are you and what do you bring to the table? And if you've read Clockers, if you've read Dennis Lane's work, if you've read Pelicanus's work, and... If you've done what Ed Burns did in life, which is to teach school in Baltimore City and police Baltimore City, and then write The Corner, you know, there's no credentials there that to be ashamed of. These are people that could write the material that we needed them to write and produce the material we needed them to produce. So you go with the lineup you have.
And we'll go with more of our callers. Randy, joining us from Sacramento this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Simon. I'm a tremendous fan of your work, and every time I hear an interview with you, I'm an aspiring writer originally from Oakland, and every time I hear an interview with you, I find things that either inspire me or just give me some insight to go on and explore. And in previous interviews, I've heard you describe the process for auditioning the character for Bunk on The Wire, and that I gather that the characters of the officers was very much generated from your time as a crime reporter, but for the characters of, say, Prop Joe or the characters of Stringer Bell or for Avon Barksdale, where did you develop those characters from? Because, you know, growing up in the streets of Oakland, you know, some of the major drug dealers of the 80s, they were kids growing up at one time, and a lot of them I knew. And it's funny because a lot of the guys that you portrayed embodied a lot of the same characteristics of the guys that I knew growing up who ended up being these largely successful, very violent drug dealers. So they're very authentic. And I know that you built your officer characters off of your experience. Where did you build your criminal characters from?
I should highlight Ed Burns' experience. His 20-year career in the police department was involved in doing major prolonged investigations involving wiretaps on the West Baltimore drug trade. He did a series of complex cases all through the 1980s and into the 90s that involved people like Melvin Williams, Rudy Williams, Warren Boardley, Tamara Stanfield, and we were drawing from those people, from those cases, and from those characters. And in fact, Melvin Williams, who Baltimoreans will know as Little Melvin, a very famous narcotics trafficker with a career going back to the 1960s, he Ed locked him up in December of '84 in a wiretap case, and Melvin came out of federal prison in 2001, and To the great credit of both men, they sort of hooked up, had lunch, and Melvin ended up playing the deacon on The Wire in his golden years of retirement. We hope he became an actor on the show, and actually, I thought he did wonderfully. But there was as much effort to acquire the voice and the characterizations of the high level narcotics traffickers as any other character in the show, and we had a great advantage with Ed Burns along and with the context that he brought from all of his casework.
And we thank Randy for his call, and we go to Sanjay. Good morning. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Thank you. So I had a question about the character Bodhi in one of the seasons. They were on a drop. They were driving somewhere, and the other characters were some of the other drug dealers were listening to hip-hop as kind of expected, and Bodhi was listening to Prairie Home Companion, and I was laughing out loud listening to that and watching that. But I want to ask you what that sort of meant for Bodhi, and were you trying to say this guy could have been somewhere else in a different world, or were you trying to say something even larger than that, or just is,
well, we had fun sort of mocking the distance between the two Americas. That was a rote thing for us every now and then, and that whole conversation on the road trip to Philly. You know, there was a moment early on when I was reporting the corner where I wanted DeAndre McCullough to know it was really going to be a book, because, you know, I knew there was going to be a 2 or 3 year delay before the book came out. You know, he's a young kid. He had agreed to sort of let me follow his life for that year, but I wanted him to know as best I could what was involved in that. And so there came a point at which I drove him to New York so we could meet the editor and he could see the publishing house and I could make it a little more real to him. And on the way to New York, I realized DeAndre had never been that far outside of Baltimore in his life. After we hit, say, Jersey, and we started to pick up the Philly radio stations, and he was stunned to find out that the radio stations in Baltimore faded and that there were other radio stations. You know, now, you can laugh at that, but it really does show you the sort of the psychic distance between, you know, what, the viable America and the America that we have isolated from ourselves and dispatched. And so I always remembered that, and I decided to use it at that point. And at some point, DeAndre started bringing cassette tapes into my car whenever we were driving somewhere. And, you know, if I heard The Chronic, you know, 4,000 times that year, I heard it once. And so at some point, we made a deal of I get to listen for 45 minutes, you get to listen, you know, then you play your tape. And, you know, so we were trading off. And one time I made him listen to Garrison Keillor just to drive him crazy.
Well, speaking about the two Americas, makes me think of Michael Harrington, of course. Here's a listener, David, who says, I'm a huge fan of The Wire, and I also read and love Mr. Simon's book, Homicide, but I can't seem to get my mother to watch even one episode of The Wire. My conclusion, some folks simply don't want to see that part of America. Does Mr. Simon agree?
I agree entirely, yeah.
By the way, your mother said something about you being in a dryer and laughing when you were a child.
Now, you've perused the back pages of The New Yorker, I see.
Yeah, well, it just sounded like a strange story. She was saying David was always a very unusual child and used that example of you being curled up in a dryer and laughing.
I think Margaret Talbot, like, lost the punchline there, which is that she asked me what I was doing in the dryer, and I was trying to take it apart from the inside and see how it worked. So there was actually a point to that, but she heard me laughing in there because I was, you know, like the pieces were, you know, the nuts and bolts were coming apart in my hand, and I was finally making progress, and she opened the dryer and found me in there. She likes to tell that story on me. It's why I don't like it when reporters get near my parents.
Nicole is joining us from Pittsburgh. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I've never been so starstruck to call into a radio show before. I just wanted to say a huge thank you. My husband and I have been fans of the show and watched it from season one, and I was a teacher in Los Angeles Unified, part of Central California, and then out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I just have to say, there was one scene that really resonated when I watched Prez go into his classroom for the first time as a new teacher and look at the disaster zone that was his room and just following how he would get things set up. And for me, that just really, like I said, resonated anyone who's ever taught in an urban classroom, you just thought at that moment, wow, whoever's writing this show obviously had to be in the classroom. And I just think you hit the nail on the head, at least as far as season four with the kids and the education system. I don't think there was anything that you missed. I can't even say that there were any inaccuracies. And I could go on and on about seasons one, two, three, four, and five. They were all amazing. But I just wanted to thank you for the first time for depicting teachers in a way that didn't make them into these superheroes that were completely unattainable or these sort of scandalous individuals that you often see depicted. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And all credit to Ed Burns, who taught for 7 years at Hamilton Middle and then City College in the city of Baltimore. And he was really channeling his experiences. And he says, I'll speak for him now, he says that being a teacher was the hardest job he ever had.
You're going to be teaching at Berkeley? You looking forward to that? Are you doing it?
It's 3 days of hanging around the journalism college, and you know, I've now realized that talking about yourself, it has a sustainability of about 36 hours, and then you just start lying because you're bored, telling the same old stuff. So there's a little bit of that, and then I am getting to meet with students who are going into journalism, which is, you know, you want to talk about a hero's journey nowadays. But
yeah,
there's a multimedia track here, and listen, they got to find some way. They got to find some way to do this job and to find an economic model that's going to work again. And so, you know, I'm trying to be as encouraging as I can while still being, while still presenting the audacity of despair.
Well, you've certainly brought a lot into people's lives, and we thank you for being with us this morning. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Ongoing success and good luck to you.
Thanks.
David Simon, creator and head writer of the HBO series The Wire, and this week, writer-in-residence at UC Berkeley School of Journalism. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And want to remind you that we are indeed thankful for your listenership, and we're also thankful for the people who help put this program on every day. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.